I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about car buying trends. We'll discuss what's hot, what's new, and what is moving upward. My guests will be automotive writer Casey Williams and Marty Murphy with the Indiana Automotive Dealers Association. Please join the conversation. You can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about trends in car buying today on No Limits. It's the show for those of you who are thinking about a new car purchase. If you have questions, we've got a couple of great experts here in the studio with us. And the way you can get in touch with them is by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are automotive writer Casey Williams and Marty Murphy with the Indiana Automotive Dealers Association. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having us.
It's good to have you here. So, let's just start with an overview of what's going on right now with within kind of the automotive car buying world. Are there big trends that are emerging? this is never a good sign. The two guests are looking at each other. But I'll tell you what, you'll each get a crack. I'll let Casey go first, and then let Marty have the second.
Yeah, we're looking at each other and laughing because Marty and I've had this conversation a few times. Mm-hmm. I think the biggest trend right now is really the move from cars to crossovers. You've seen that in the General Motors announcements in recent weeks, closing multiple assembly plants. General Motors is getting rid of the Chevy Cruze, the Chevy Volt, the Chevy Impala, Buick LaCrosse, Cadillac XTS, and Cadillac CT6. So there's really a big move from cars into crossovers.
Probably ought to define what a crossover is.
Crossover is an SUV that's based on a car architecture.
Yeah, so it's a smaller, like a smaller version of an SUV that handles a little bit better, at least in theory, right?
It's essentially a tall station wagon if you think of it that way.
That's the other way to go. Marty,
well,
your view?
Our dealers give us the feedback that when the consumers have an opportunity to sit up a little higher and have a little more room, and that's what these crossovers offer, it's hard to go back to a car. So even once they have a taste of that, so now all the safety features and everything that are coming into these vehicles are being designed to enhance that comfortable experience. And the regular car platform just doesn't seem to do it, except for maybe older drivers.
Well, that's what I was going to go with. How much of this is also an older thing? When I was in my 20s, dropping down into a relatively low-slung sports car, seemed kind of exciting. Now it's an adventure.
Yes.
getting in and out.
So how much
of this is the product of also kind of an aging population?
Well, that's certainly a factor. But we'll probably talk about it. We've got autonomous vehicles that are going to come into play that may make the difference for seniors who have trouble getting in and out of cars or maybe shouldn't be driving at all under their own power. So age is a factor, but I think a lot of it is just the taste for the vehicle, what it offers.
Okay.
It's a lot more flexible, a lot more space inside. And to Marty's point, I think it's a combination. It's young families, wanting a big vehicle for kids, but also older drivers, it's much easier to slide in and out of it and not to stoop down to the vehicle.
Yeah, I remember there was a moment, not long after my wife and I started our family, when a group of my buddies and I were standing out in the driveway and all comparing our minivans and realizing, oh, yes, we have moved to a new stage of life. These are now the vehicles we talk about and all of that sort of stuff. So is this the case at sort of every, and I'm struggling for the term, every demographic point here? I mean, are these on lower-end vehicles or the higher end? Are we seeing that the, you know, the smaller cars are going away and the crossovers are now dominating the market at every point? I'll start with Casey on that, but I want to hear Marty's thoughts as well.
It's across the spectrum. I mean, the automakers are making subcompact crossovers that are, you know, $20,000 vehicles, and they're making very high-end crossovers that are $100,000 plus. And if you look at, you know, Rolls-Royce and Bentley, they're $350,000 plus. So it's a spectrum of compact cars to midsize to large.
Marty.
I agree, and the traffic patterns that we see in the dealerships and what they offer, because, you know, you only have limited inventory. So, you know, the dealer that has the hot products that they want is the ones they go to, and sometimes that's the mega dealer who has the ability to have that kind of inventory on site, where, you know, the people that come into a smaller rural dealer that maybe only has two or three SUVs to look at, you know, he may not be interested in going to visit that dealer at all. So the challenge for the dealer is having the products, enough products that people want, and they make room by not buying so many of the cars anymore.
So are we going to see the end sort of compacts as we think? You know, like in my case, after years of driving minivans and then SUVs, once my kids got grown and started driving themselves, I get around in a Prius now.
Yeah.
Because I'm generally driving just myself, and that's the most efficient way to do it, and I've found that it's a comfortable car. Are we going to see those sorts of cars disappearing with this? Because are you going to be able to have that kind of efficiency with a crossover? Marty, you're looking perplexed.
Well, so I think a lot of it has to do with gas prices staying cheap. Mm-hmm. As long as gas prices are cheap, driving SUVs and pickup trucks and the other vehicles that are not really very fuel efficient, you know, it's still manageable. A few years back when gas was a dollar more a gallon, Priuses were selling like crazy. Mm-hmm. And with the technology that's coming along with electric vehicles, they're going to be smaller, again, because of the weight of the vehicle and what you want to have to make, you know, the mm-hmm. make the battery last. So I think you're going to see a platform for smaller vehicles that are fuel efficient, whether it's, you know, fuel cell or electric or hybrid.
Casey.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at what just happened at the LA Auto Show, Toyota has a new hybrid Corolla coming to the market. Mm-hmm. They have a new all-wheel drive Prius coming to market. So while the domestic automakers are getting rid of their smaller cars, you know, the Japanese automakers seem to be investing in them and deciding there's a market for it. But they're also the top players. So, you know, as that market becomes smaller, you know, it's going to filter out, and it's going to be a top three players or so that really dominate it. And domestics probably won't be that.
And I'll stay with you, Casey, because we've talked about, made reference here and alluded to electric cars a couple of times. You know, are they now an emerging force in the market? I mean, most of the guys I know who have them, it's almost like a hobby purchase or, you know, a passion thing. How far away are they from being major players in the market?
They're still low volume. Mm-hmm. I think what really makes them, will make them popular, a range, and you start seeing, you know, Tesla Model 3 getting 300 miles. You see the Chevy Bolt in the 250-mile range. As that range increases to beyond 300 miles and you get a recharge, you know, 15, 20 minutes, mm-hmm. they're going to become popular. The challenge now is they tend to be expensive cars, mm-hmm. and the recharge tends to take a while.
Yeah, the people who are buying them now are really underwriting the R&D costs.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah. So... are you seeing that at all, Marty? Are the dealers finding that there's a greater demand, or is it still at a sort of an under-the-radar screen?
It's pretty low demand at this time still from a dealer perspective. The people that care about that have done the research, and they go out and they either buy a Tesla or they buy something that's more of a, like you say, a hobby car that they want to say that they were an early adapter. And again, you run into those challenges that the grid's not set up to handle multiple charges and things. So until we see that platform expand to accommodate, I mean, it's just not a realistic option for a lot of people.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about cars and car buying trends today on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So the other big change, obviously, that's out there that we made reference to, and I think actually we were talking about it quite a bit the last time Casey was on the program, is the increasingly imminent arrival of the autonomous or driverless vehicles. How big a force is that? And are dealers, how are they anticipating that they're going to market those and deal with that change? Marty?
Well, it is a significant force that we have a lot of attention focused on trying to anticipate, because it's hard to plan when you don't know what that metric's going to be. We feel like autonomous cars are going to be here, maybe not as fast as people think they will be, but they're going to be here pretty soon. And dealers don't think that people are going to quit driving, but they may start owning only one car instead of two and changing their buying habits that way. But we're still going to be needed to service vehicles, and those autonomous vehicles are going to need serviced. So there's a place for the dealer to pick up activity in that different segment of the market.
How far away are they, Casey, would you say, from being a major slice of the market?
You're still 5 to 10 years out, probably.
Okay.
And you'll see, and you're starting to see it now, you see the features come out of the vehicles. You see adaptive cruise control with auto stop start. You're seeing lane centering systems. You're seeing some of those, some of the roots of those technologies coming into cars now. And at some point they'll come together and they'll gel and it'll be safe enough and we'll be all right.
My wife just bought a new car and I'm shocked at how much of the driving it does already. Mm-hmm. Before you go ahead. I'm sorry, I cut you off.
No, that's all right. I just got a new Mercedes E-Class as my test car this week, and it has the self-centering system on it, adaptive cruise and everything. But I think safety is going to be the key part of this. Tesla got out there quick. They had some accidents, and I think everybody kind of said, okay, let's back up just a second. Mm-hmm. The technology is available to us, but let's make sure we can do it safely, make sure everybody's comfortable, and make sure that there's no gaps in this.
So, I guess I want to ask, and I'll stay with Casey first, but how is this, when this does arrive, whether it's 5 years or 10 years from now, how is it going to change the business and the sort of practice of buying cars, in your view? Because this, it sounds to me like this is a pretty seismic shift in the way we would approach these things. I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but driving right now is kind of a partnership between you and the machine. And if it's an autonomous vehicle, it becomes much more you're simply an occupant while the machine does the work. I'll start with you, Casey.
Well, as long as we still need a machine to get us to work and back or get us to the store back, I mean, at the end of the day, you're still going to buy a machine, whether you drive it or somebody else drives it. And a lot of the automakers will tell you that their intent is still for you to be able to drive that vehicle on the weekends and enjoy it if you'd like to, but to take the sting out of the morning commutes. So that's coming. I think what could change the market is, maybe you only have one car. Maybe it can take, one spouse to work and back and go pick up their spouse, take them to work. And, one car can kind of drive itself around and do that too. I mean, you're thinking further out. But, that kind of stuff could really change it. But I think the bigger change may be some of the ride sharing,
Well, and I guess part of what I was thinking is, in a car culture like the United States, what you drive says an awful lot about who you are.
Yeah.
What you value, what kind of statement you want to make about yourself. It's one thing to drive a muscle car as opposed to driving a Prius and all of that. A lot of the advertising, the marketing of vehicles plays to that sense. How's that going to change if the driving becomes a much more passive experience, Marty?
Well, we've already seen that shift, because when you see young people coming up, when I was a kid in the 70s and got my driver's license, I got it the very first day I could.
Oh, yeah.
I've got a nephew that's 18 and still doesn't have one and doesn't care, because he gets rides or he Ubers. And it's one of those things that kids are more into experiences than having stuff. And we see that affecting in the future how that works. And a big part of the reason that we think this is necessary is distracted driving is significant. Mm-hmm. I mean, you get in any car and they've got it in their hand. And if we can reduce accidents and save lives by coming up with this, then we're going to be all set.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about car buying trends on No Limits today. If you want to join the conversation, you can do so in any one of several ways. You can give us a call at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are automotive writer Casey Williams, in his second appearance on the program, and Marty Murphy with the Indiana Automotive Dealers Association. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about cars and car buying trends here on No Limits. My guests are automotive writer Casey Williams and Marty Murphy with the Indiana Automotive Dealers Association. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Okay, so we've dealt with the serious big picture stuff. We've had the kind of eat your vegetables portion of the conversation. Now let's talk about the fun stuff. What is out there right now that is really cool, really exciting, that people are really fascinated by and drawn to? Keeping in mind, again, this is a car culture. People love this stuff. So, Marty.
Well, we're excited. Here in Indianapolis, we have an auto show that starts the day after Christmas to New Year's Day, and we're fortunate to have the new Jeep. It's the Gladiator, and it's a pickup truck, mid-size pickup truck, and it's doors off, top off, pickup truck. So it's kind of exciting. It's a little bit different. It brings in the Jeep experience and still has the utility of a truck bed.
Is that what makes it distinctive from the other things, other vehicles sort of in that class?
Well, the fact that the doors come off and it's more of a party vehicle, like a regular Jeep.
So it was like an old-fashioned Jeep almost, but
the windshield,
a little sportier.
The windshield will fold down like the old Jeeps did. So it's kind of a road, over-the-road vehicle.
Okay, Casey, what do you think? What's cool?
I agree. I think if I was going to the auto show, I'd want to see the Gladiator. Very, very cool vehicle. Nothing like it on the market. And again, it's basically a Jeep. It's a Jeep Wrangler Unlimited with a bed on the back. So you can tow with it, you can haul with it, and you can go splash around with it and have a good time. I think the other vehicle that's going to be at the show that's going to be really cool is the Hyundai Palisade that just was unveiled in Los Angeles. Big three-row crossover, luxurious, and something totally different from Hyundai. I think that'll be a really cool vehicle there.
I agree. Right, that's an eight-passenger vehicle that Hyundai's, they're spending a lot of money to make this have a lot of the technology, like wireless phone charging, rear occupant alert. So, if you forget your dog or your child in the car, it tells you. It's got the heads-up display on the windshield, which is kind of high-tech, keeps you out of trouble and keeps your head watching the road. So a lot of good features in that vehicle.
We're talking about cars and car buying here on No Limits and Car Buying Trends. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named David has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. David, you're on the air.
How you doing?
Doing fine. What's on your mind?
I got two questions. On the autonomous vehicle, how much does it cost to charge a vehicle at the charging stations? And question two is, can you get a DUI with an autonomous vehicle?
Oh, okay. Good question. I'll start with Marty on that one. Thanks very much for the call, David.
Uh-huh.
Right now, the charging stations don't have charges associated with monetary charges associated with them because they're most of them are owned by the manufacturer that put them installed them. Unless you're at like the city county building or somewhere where they're trying to encourage it, and again, it doesn't cost you to do that. The DUI will have to be something that's probably addressed in the state laws because someone is driving that vehicle. But it might be a good solution for a person to get home to call one and be like a driverless Uber, I would think.
Casey, you're looking like you want to lean in and address that.
No, I think where he was going is the next step is if you've got an autonomous car and you're at the bar drunk, you know, you call the car, you sit in the back seat, and it drives you home.
Yeah.
It seems to me to be an advantage for that.
So then it becomes less a question of driving under the influence. If you're out in public, I suppose you're still subject to public intoxication statutes. But, yeah, in some ways it is the equivalent of – and it picks up on the point Marty was making earlier that the bigger argument for autonomous vehicles is that, if they can be made safer and reduce that element of human error, then – that's a huge inducement.
And going a step further, I think what I really think is that baby boomers are really going to demand these cars as they get older, because they're not going to sit home. You know, they're going to go out in the driveway, get in their autonomous car, and go to the doctor's appointment, or go out to eat, or do the things they've always done. And I think that's going to be a huge advantage for those cars going forward.
Well, is it also? I mean, and I think it was Casey who alluded to this. Is one of the appeals of them also like? I think I have a fairly long commute back and forth to work, and I spend a lot of time in my car. There are times I think, okay, if something else were driving me back and forth and I could be reading or, you know, dealing with a backlog of correspondence or moving paperwork or, you know, returning my call list, which I sort of do anyway because I can go hands-free with the car – these days, that would be, you know, probably another hour and a half of productivity every day. Is that going to be part of the appeal of this, too, is that a lot of these folks will begin to think of their commutes as something much different rather than a hassle? It's just you have a different kind of office. Marty?
I've had it expressed to me that, for example, if you live in the suburbs and you work downtown, you're paying $150, $200 a month to park, and you can ride into work with your spouse and have a conversation and eat a Pop-Tart on the way and not worry about it, get dropped off at the front door and not worry about cleaning the snow off or doing any of the things you might have to do. It's very convenient. And then to not have the financial commitment of insurance and all those other things, you know, it pencils out for some people pretty well.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about cars and car buying trends here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can do what a listener named Steve has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Steve, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, everybody. I have not joined the electric car generation yet, but I'm concerned about how they're paying for the roads, because we pay the gas cars, they pay for road repairs through gas tax. How do the electric cars compensate for that?
Good question. Thanks very much for the call, Steve. So, Casey, I'll throw that one to you first.
Well, that's a very good question. And obviously, they're not using gas. Obviously, owners are paying license fees to the state and any other applicable fees to the car. But you know, as we've been talking about, you know, a lot of the utilities are not charging for that right now, or at least the businesses that have plugins. So I think as more electric cars come on the road, if they come on the road, that, you know, they're going to have to charge and have to tax that probably to some degree.
Well, it sounds like they're going to have to develop a whole new system to kind of account for and tax this. Yeah, Marty, you're leaning
in. We had that come up at the legislature the last 2 years in a row. And because the road, you know, we're looking at the road use taxes that are applied to gasoline, and they're trying to distribute those fairly for the. So they're looking at an annual license or a permit fee, and the trouble is trying to figure out what's an appropriate number that makes it fair, because the trucks, you know, pick up a big part of it with the diesel fuel taxes and the heavy vehicle use fees and stuff that they pay, but every car driver, you know, pays at the pump for the road use, because a lot of that money goes back into it. And the electric car and fuel cell people have pushed back real hard because they don't want that fee to be a discouraging part of the implementation. They want to get some of these cars on the road before they start throwing out a fee that would might be a deterrent to get people to participate.
Well, and we've seen this. A listener who didn't want to go on the air makes the point that U.S. hybrid drivers already are paying an extra fee for driving a hybrid vehicle to sort of compensate for the lost gas tax revenues. How savage do you think these battles are going to be politically as more of this stuff? Because we're not talking about small sums of money that are involved here. I'll stay with you, Marty, since you're making me just take a look at me in the eye.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of skin in the game. I mean, the people that provide these services are going to be responsible for probably collecting it. So they want to make sure that whatever happens does not discourage use of their product, whether it's fuel or electric, and or fuel cells, and they show up in big numbers at the State House to weigh in on this. So it's very heavily lobbied.
And is this fight gonna how quickly do you think this fight is going to intensify, Casey?
Well, it all depends on how fast we're able to adopt electric cars. I mean, if prices come down and battery costs come down and we can buy them, you know, it could be the next 5 years, you know. But it just hasn't come down in cost quite as dramatically as I think people thought it would.
So, and again, I'm going to ask a question sort of about how, you know, one of the things that I was having drinks not long ago with a guy who owns a Tesla. And I don't know whether this is accurate or not, but he said, you know, one of the virtues of buying an electric car is that, you know, at least in theory, because it's not an internal combustion thing, it's not supposed to wear down. You know, the engine should at least supposed to be operating the same way 50, 60 years from now that it does right now. Which would mean, since there's a certain amount of, you know, I don't want to use the term planned obsolescence, but, you know, the fact that we buy several cars, most people consider themselves pretty lucky if they get anywhere from 7 to 10 years out of a vehicle. How is that going to change the way the whole business is organized if people are buying cars instead of 8, 10, 15 times in a lifetime, if not more, 3 or 4 times in a lifetime, Marty?
I can tell you from the dealer perspective, we've looked at plans that we're going to have to change our hours, because when you have autonomous vehicles, for example, that are owned a fleet by somebody, mm-hmm. and they're running all day long, and they're not wearing out, but they're using up tires and they're using up brakes, and those are the things that are going to need to be serviced and changed for the safety even of the autonomous use. And we're going to have our service centers open in the evenings to accommodate the downtime to get those kind of like a pit stop, if you can imagine. Go in and quick, mm-hmm. get a quick change, get it updated, and get it back available for it to be on the road during the busy time. So we are planning on adjusting for that. Because we know that the, like you said, the motor doesn't wear out, the battery's got to, you know, the better the battery. I mean, that's the big mm-hmm. purchase price. I mean, that's the big replacement cost. But virtually everything else is a onboard computer mm-hmm. run operation, and it's just brakes and tires that you need to worry about.
Casey, how do you think it's going to change the business?
Well, obviously, electric cars should require less maintenance. I mean, that's the pitch, you know, from the automakers. Mm-hmm. But to Marty's point, you know, there are brakes and tires and other components mm-hmm. that can fail. And batteries don't last forever. I mean, you think about your cell phone, think about your laptop. You know, those batteries eventually don't charge as well and don't discharge as well. Now, the automakers have designed the software that accompanies them to try to prevent those batteries from degrading tremendously over time. But they're not going to last forever, just like a gas engine won't last forever.
We are talking about cars and car buying trends today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So I want to ask this. You know, part of it, the context in which GM's made some of its decisions about moving some operations overseas, at least some of the analysis suggests that the tariffs and some of the other, you know, trade conflicts have played a part in that. Are we starting to see the effects of some of the tariffs and the trade war, particularly with China, here in this country? Is it affecting car buying in any way? Marty, you're looking pensive when I ask the question, so I'm going to go with you.
Well, I think General Motors has taken advantage of that position to kind of further something they probably see they need to do. If you look at all the manufacturers, they have seemed to make decisions based on pleasing stockholders more than, you know, say a Ford or a Fiat Chrysler has demonstrated. So their willingness to, you know, because all those other manufacturers are still dealing with this, you know, similar tariff situations, and they're not providing that as the solution. So I think it's an opportunity to throw that as a reason we're doing something we want to do anyway.
Okay. Casey.
Yeah, I think what was interesting when all the General Motors announcements were being made is, you know, they're going to close a plant in Ohio. They're going to close a plant in Detroit, for example, and they're going to close a plant in Canada. But the new Chevy Blazer, that's their new midsize crossover that'll be out, you know, first of the year, they're building it in Mexico. They build vehicles on that same platform here in the United States, build them in both Michigan and in Tennessee, but they've chosen to build that vehicle down there. So I think, and I think they're probably doing it for very rational reasons in terms of plant capacity. I've heard GM CEO Mary Barra say it's because of the paint booth, and that becomes a capacity issue, becomes an emissions issue for the plants. So I think they have legitimate reasons. But I think I'm guessing the UAW and others will start having some pretty firm questions about why are you closing the plants in the U.S. and why are you building your hot new vehicles in Mexico and other places? And I think it's going to get kind of hard for them to explain.
We've gotten a tweet from a listener named Teresa that I've never thought of before. Good question, Teresa. And again, if anyone wants to join the conversation via Twitter, you can find us at WFYI. Teresa writes, what mileage is best when trading in a used car on the odometer? Meaning, what's sort of the best point at which to consider trading a used vehicle to get the most for it? Marty?
Well, the best is to be before the manufacturer's warranty is completely run out. So if you could trade it in while there's still a little bit of warranty left on it, that's a selling point for the dealer to resell that vehicle along with an extended warranty.
Casey, any other thoughts on besides the warranty?
Yeah, I would agree with Marty. It seems that most cars somewhere around 100,000 miles start having some pretty significant servicing, and then you kind of get through that servicing and you get on, and cars can last a very long time after that. But it seems somewhere around 100,000 miles you start running some bigger expenses.
Is it better to try to sell the car on your own or trade it in, Casey? Would you say?
Well, the dealers are going to treat you fairly, but the dealers have to make a profit on that car too. Flip side of this is you've got to spend time and money to sell it independently if you're going to sell it for yourself. So I think some of the dealers is a matter of convenience for you. I think selling your own is probably if you're trying to make a little bit of money play with it.
Yeah, I've always heard that the argument, at least from financial people for doing the trade-in also, is that because it knocks down the sale price,
you avoid
tax liability. I see Marty nodding his head. You probably can explain this better than I can.
Right. With the trade-in, you get a sales tax allowance that credits towards your new purchase that you don't get when you sell it on your own. So you have to factor that into your decision. And a lot of it has to do with, you know, I had 7 kids, so I had cars that were only worth $1,000 or $1,500. So it was easier for me to stick a sign on it and have some other neighbor kid take a chance on one of those than try to go trade it in for anything that you know a dealer is going to take it to the auction and do the same thing with.
We are talking about cars and car buying trends here on No Limits today. My guests are automotive writer Casey Williams and Marty Murphy with the Indiana Automotive Dealers Association. I'm John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please Stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about cars and car buying trends today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Marty Murphy with the Indiana Automotive Dealers Association and automotive writer Casey Williams. Again, if you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Sterling has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Sterling, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm actually also an automotive writer. Hi, Casey. But I've done quite a bit of research for a piece I wrote a few years ago into the tax issue with cars, and I think the idea of continuing to base our road repairs on some sort of consumable tax for car use is kind of dead in the water, with because the only consumables left are, like we mentioned earlier, brakes and tires, which you definitely don't want people to be disincentivized to keeping those fresh and up to date. So to me, I think the only real solution to that problem is to move that into a part of state, federal, and local budgets and make that a part of what comes out of our income taxes or, you know, other tax revenue sources. Making it car-specific probably isn't going to work too well in the future.
Thanks very much for the call and for the research, Sterling. Casey or Marty, either one.
I think the first thing we need, I think the first thing we think about is, you know, electric cars are a really small part of what people buy in cars today. So I think it's something that's coming. I think it's something that's not a crisis today, but something we need to consider. But I think it's going to be contentious, because I think, as we talked about earlier, there's going to be this push and pull between incentivizing people to buy electric cars so we're not using foreign oil and we can, you know, produce energy domestically for all the cars. And the tax base that's going to kind of wither away over time. So I think there will be a push and pull, but we'll have to find a happy medium somewhere.
How much of this? It sounds like, Marty, you've been around the legislature in dealing with this. Is also a product of the fact that, you know, stripped of flourishes in many ways, the kind of taxes we're talking about are sales taxes.
Right.
And that makes the amount you're paying a little easier to hide if you're a politician. Because very few of us look at, you know, how much we pay in taxes when we go to the grocery store or we make a purchase at, you know, at any other store. And certainly we don't even see it when we go to the gas pump.
Right.
So I understand what Sterling is saying, and that very likely would be the most efficient way to do it. On the other hand, I can see a lot of politicians saying, oh, no, well, I'm not going to vote on that.
part of the political concern is that is an opportunity to slow down the traction that this segment's trying to gain. So if you're opposed to that for whatever reason, because you're selling gasoline cars and you don't want them to get traction, and you're not selling electric cars, or you're not ready for that to expand as fast as it's being promoted, then one of the ways to slow it down is to throw that issue out there and say, well, what about the way you're using up the roads? And as Casey alluded, it's a very small percentage. And quite frankly, the lighter vehicle is going to do less damage to the road. So there's an argument probably that we could wait a little while to assess the best way to tax that after they became more significant on the road.
We've gotten, let's see, it's looks like an email from a listener named Josh. Again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. It says, as an owner of a used Nissan Leaf Electric, in Indiana, I pay an extra $150 annually. It varies by state. Hybrids pay $50. Are we going to see these kinds of discrepancies in this kind of nuanced approach to depending on what kind of fuel-efficient car and how basically how it's powered? You're going to have to figure out where it fits in the tax schedule. Marty.
Well, I think the formulas they've used in the past to try to come to this is to come up with the average. If the average is 15,000 miles a year road use and you figure out a vehicle gets 20 miles to the gallon and the taxes are, that are in a gallon of gas are X, then they can come up with a number that they have to hit that is comparable. So they can back into that by the average use. And I think that's what they've tried to do with these vehicles. So if you're, I think it would be different if you were a for-hire car that was out there all the time versus an individual owner. I think you would have different license fees for those because of the fact that you're running all day long and the other one's just maybe back and forth to work.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about cars and car buying trends here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named John has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. John, you're on the air.
Hey, good afternoon. I find this topic very fascinating, so thank you for including it. I'm curious on autonomous vehicles. I know everybody follows the posted speed limit rules, but I'm curious, how autonomous vehicles handle speed limits?
Okay.
And will there be the ability to override that? I guess I'm just curious about that in a kind of funny light.
Yeah, you had your tongue embedded deeply in your cheek in the first part of that. Thanks very much, John, for the call.
No problem.
So, Casey.
I think it poses a pretty ethical dilemma here. If you drive a new car and all the cars have navigation systems, the car already knows what the speed limit is. It's programmed into the nav system. So that information is already in the car, already programmed in the car. The question is, will somebody legislate that the car can only go that fast or not? And what happens if you drive faster than that? So I think there's going to be a lot of dilemmas that come along with this. Of that, the technology is there absolutely to keep you from driving over that speed limit, but what will they, and is that any different than today?
Yeah, as I say, with a brand new car my wife got, I noticed on the screen, every time we move to a speed zone, the sign pops up to remind you of what the speed is now. Marty, your thoughts?
Well, I think that there's some concern that the autonomous vehicle is going to be out there with, regular vehicles, and it's going to have to communicate with a vehicle that it maybe is speeding that it needs to get out of the way of or stay up with in traffic. So they're going to have to accommodate that flow that may well be over the speed limit to keep you safe at certain points in the process. Because if you had an accident and they were slowing way down and then you were accelerating to get back up to the speed limit, you might be over for a while just to get back up and getting back in the flow. So they have to accommodate that.
Got a tweet from a listener, and again, our address on Twitter is WFYI. This listener writes, what none of the electric car companies are saying is how they are getting all the lithium and cobalt that they are using and what are their plans to dispose of depleted batteries. Marty?
Well, that's a good question because there's not a plan in place to dispose that anyone likes. Mm-hmm. It's like so many things, like we had with tires and everything else, not in my backyard, go do it somewhere mm-hmm. else. So the quest is still to come up with a smaller, better battery. And when they do that, that's going to take care of a lot of those problems. But right now, we don't have a good answer that I'm aware of.
Casey.
Yeah, Marty knows far better than I do.
We are talking about cars and car buying trends here on No Limits. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi, John.
Hi.
I listen to you a lot, a whole lot. I'm a former title clerk. I work for Tom Wood Lexus. I know you, Mike Murphy, from way back.
Anyway,
my question is, with the increase of production of the huge behemoth SUVs that are being sold at rock bottom prices because the gas is so low, I think that in cases like this, I think maybe we're overproducing. It seems like there's an awful lot that's going into the landfill that doesn't need to be. There's an awful lot of waste that within the car industry that is sort of self-made. And I think if we could become a little more mindful about what we use and consider everything has to go somewhere. Every product, everything that you use to make a car has to come from somewhere and go from somewhere. And I think less is more. I really do.
Thanks very much for the call, Kathy. I'll start with Casey on that one. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, thanks, Kathy. And I see where she's coming from. You know, you buy a big vehicle and it's got lots of sheet metal and aluminum in it, and it all has to go somewhere. But I think there are other factors that tend to, you know, force people to do different things, or at least encourage them to. It's, you know, the price of the vehicles tend to be higher. Fuel usage is higher. So there are things that keep those really big full-size SUVs from really just being dominant. I think the vehicles that we're seeing increasing in volume are smaller mid-size crossovers that are car-based. So I don't think we're seeing as many of the huge vehicles. You know, there's Chevy Tahoe, Chevy Suburban, new Ford Expedition do well. But that's not the overwhelming part of the market.
Since Kathy referenced you, Marty, I figure I ought to give you a crack
sure.
at that one, too.
Well, I think we government was mindful of this concern when they had the Cash for Clunkers program a few years back to take a lot of the big gas hogs off the road. And it broke my heart because I would see a big Excursion in the back of a dealership, and they were pouring liquid glass into the block of that engine to make sure that it never got back on the road again. So, you know, those really, really bad players are off and out of the way, and it might come time to do that again to thin the herd if we need to do that to get just more fuel efficient. But we know that model worked well before, and I think we could implement it again if we had to.
Again, if you want to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881, as a listener named Jeff has done. Jeff, you're on the air.
Back to electric cars. Every consumer that has electric car at their house, they would have a special meter to charge their car, and when they charge their car, they would pay a higher rate to the electric company, and you'd have the utility company collect that extra rate money for the state.
Oh, to support road taxes and all of
yes.
that. Pay for
yeah.
the roads. Okay. Well, thanks very much for the call and the idea, Jeff. Marty, your thoughts?
Thank you. I think that's an interesting concept, but in theory, one of the things that people talk about are having solar panels on the mm-hmm. roof of their house so they can charge their cars and make their own electricity and maybe even sell some of the extra back to the electric company. So I'm not sure we would get an opportunity to funnel it through the electric company that way if the plan rolled out the way some people plan for it to.
I remember a couple of years ago, General Motors was proposing the idea of selling fuel cells for home use to generate
right.
electricity for your electric cars.
Well, it just sounds – I'm sorry if I cut you off, Casey.
That's
but
right.
No, as you guys were talking, I'm thinking, man, this is going to be a fascinating discussion to have 10 years from now.
Yes.
When we're sitting here and thinking about all the ways that this is going to change the way – not just the way cars are sold, but the way people live and society itself is structured. I apologize again, Casey.
No, absolutely. You're absolutely right. I think – it's going to ramp up, but I think you're in 5 to 10 years out before it becomes, you know, a real situation.
We're talking about cars and car buying trends here on No Limits today. Sean, you're on the air.
Hi, my question is, have any of the manufacturers begun to compensate for the increased prices in steel with other materials such as carbon fiber or something that's cheaper to manufacture domestically?
Thanks very much for the call and the question. Marty.
Well, that's a consideration. Some of the higher-end vehicles, like some of the Porsches and BMWs, have looked into that as alternatives, but I don't think there's been a big shift yet because that more expensive steel has been relatively new in the cycle that we're currently in.
How long will it be before you see an impact, do you think, really? Because, as you say, this is relatively recent. Most of the cars we're selling now are on the assembly line
sure.
long before it came into place.
It's so volatile right now because we don't know. I mean, I can't remember a more political time when the leader was ready to make significant changes like President Trump has. I mean, he will say, I'm going to do this and I'll take the heat and I'm going to do that. So, I mean, you're just not sure what's coming. It could be significant, even more significant than it already is.
Is that volatility good or bad for the car buying business or car selling business?
Well, it's short-term pain, long-term gain, I think, is the hope. I think that's what the plan is that, okay, it may slow down car sales for a while, but if we get, you know, production up and we get jobs up and we get other things up, it'll make our economy more strong and more self-sufficient. I think that's the plan, but early on it's scary because we're thinking, man, we're going to be stuck with a bunch of cars we can't sell.
We are talking about cars and car buying trends here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named John has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. John, we're getting close on time, so I'm going to ask you to be quick.
Yes, I was just curious how these self-driving cars are going to react to emergency vehicles like a fire truck or even a police car coming up behind you with its sirens on. Is it going to stop automatically or what's going to happen?
Thanks very much for the call and the question. Casey.
My assumption is that they'd be programmed to do that. You know, keep in mind the self-driving cars we're talking about in the short term, you know, the Tesla's been talking about and others. Their vision is that you're still going to be a driver behind the wheel of that car. It's like operating a, you know, jet airliner on autopilot. You're going to be there. You're going to be monitoring. You're going to be the eyes and ears for that car for some period of time. You know, we're talking about fully automated cars. You know, we're probably 10 years out to where that those kinds of questions really come into play.
Okay, so we're getting close to the end of the program here. I know I asked about the things that, you know, the cars that were creating the most buzz, and you mentioned the Jeep and all of that. If there is one hidden gem out there, one car that when people have a fair amount of time over the holidays to get out to a dealership, they ought to go take a look at and see if they can test drive just because it's fun. What would that be? I'll start with Marty.
Well, I guess I should promote our Subaru Ascent. It's built here in Indiana, and it's a three-seat Subaru that is very popular. And eight passengers, got all the safety bells and whistles that any other vehicle has, and the popularity and durability of a Subaru. So I think that'd be a good one to go look at.
Okay, and Casey, how about you? What would you push people toward?
Well, while there's not much snow and ice on the ground, go drive a sports car. Go drive, you know, a Fiat Spider, go drive a Mazda Miata, go drive a Corvette, go drive a Porsche, and just go have that fun and thrill of driving one of those cars just once in your life.
I think that'll have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests, automotive writer Casey Williams and Marty Murphy with the Indiana Automotive Dealers Association, for what's been a lively conversation about cars and car buying. Also like to thank our listeners for some great and informative questions and comments. We will be back next Tuesday. We're going to be talking about shopping small during the holidays. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.